We will have questions, we will deliberate, and some of you have submitted written responses on these various issues. And today we will hear and gather information, and tomorrow we will actually begin our deliberations. We have quite a long afternoon. I do want to advise everyone that anything said in this room at this time is part of the open public record. We may have press present at some time, and so it may end up in the front page of the newspaper. Highly unlikely, but it's always a possibility. And so I want you all to know that it's all open presentation. So, with that said, the procedure would be, we have the agenda which we've been publicizing, and we'll have hearings on individual topics, and then we will proceed to an open mic forum after that. There will be a break in the middle of it. So I would like to go ahead and get started with the hearing on the proposed budget cut to discontinue the master's program in the Department of Classics in the College of Arts and Sciences. And we have presenting to Stephen Burnett and Cindy White Crawford.
Today. I don't wish to contest the elimination of the Classics MA program, which was frozen in July of 2007. I do question the supposed connection between the MA program and the professor of practice position. Since all the classes in my department taught by all faculty during the entire period that Professor Watkins employed as a professor of practice were undergraduate classes, the impact of this cut will be felt only by undergraduates. The appeal will be made in two parts. Professor Crawford, my predecessor's chair, will discuss the program cut in light of the actual curriculum of the department and Professor Watkins' duties as a professor of practice. I will explain the impact of the personnel cut on my department and its majors and our college and university priorities. Professor Crawford.
I'd like to give the committee some history regarding our master's program, which to all intents and purposes has been closed since 2007, and also Professor Watley's history with the department and our understanding of his place in and contribution to our undergraduate curriculum. In 2006, our MA program came under scrutiny from the Coordinating Commission for Post-Secondary Education, because it did not meet the graduation thresholds for MA programs, which are 5 students per year. This, in fact, had always been the case since we graduated at most 3 students per year, but the CCPE was becoming more strict about enforcing its thresholds. Therefore, in consultation with the dean and the senior vice chancellor, the department decided to freeze admission to the MA program while we searched for a way to reconfigure the program to meet the CCPE threshold. As a result, we have not admitted any new graduate students since 2007, and our entire faculty effort has been devoted to undergraduate teaching. The master's students who were already in the program were allowed to finish, but no 900-level courses were offered to them by the department. Our last remaining graduate student graduated on Saturday, and we were preparing, I believe, to close the program. So the chancellor has merely anticipated our own departmental action. Therefore, it should be evident that Professor Watley's position in no way supports senior faculty teaching of graduate students, since all faculty at all ranks teach only undergraduate courses. Further, since we are a department that houses 2 disciplines, classics and religious studies, over half the department's faculty, including one of the senior faculty mentioned in the justification, have never participated in the department's graduate courses at all, never offering courses for classics graduate students, but only for religious studies undergraduates and general education courses. Professor Watley has been teaching in our department for over a decade, at first as an adjunct on a course-by-course basis. In 2006, I was able to move him to a half-time lecturer position so that the department could better anticipate and plan for undergraduate enrollment pressures. At the time the professors of practice line was created, we requested that Professor Watley be moved to that track and his position be made full-time, again, so that we could better anticipate and handle undergraduate enrollment pressures. He was made full-time with the understanding that he would continue to regularly teach classical mythology, our highest enrollment course. He has done so along with other high enrollment courses in religious studies. Further, it was understood that one half of his teaching would be devoted to classics and one half to religious studies, and that as a regular member of our department, he would develop unique courses to enrich our undergraduate curriculum. This he has done, as Professor Burnett will demonstrate.
My part of the presentation is to explain the impact of the personnel cut on student credit hour production, on our majors, and our college and university priority programs. First, student credit hour production. I provide a summary of student credit hours produced by my entire department for the past 3 years. Professor Holley has produced more than anyone else. A comparison between his salary and benefits, $40,852 per year, and the tuition that he brought in each of these years reveals that he produced low-cost student credit hours at a furious rate. Second, Professor Watley's contributions to our majors. He taught 8 courses for majors. With his departure, he will lose 4 of them. He taught 4 of the 8 core courses for majors. In the Classics and Religious Studies major, we have a shared core of 8 possible courses. He taught 4 of them. We can cover 3, we will lose 1. He developed 3 of his own courses for majors in his particular area of specialization, which is early Christianity. He taught all 3 of these under the Religion 398 number. Apocalypticism, Letters of Paul, a New Testament course, and early Christian letters. These courses will not be replaced. Our number of majors has been growing in recent years. Both the Senior Vice Chancellor and my Dean encouraged my unit to recruit more majors in their responses to our department's 2009 APR. The loss of these courses for majors will make it more difficult for our students to complete their degrees in a timely manner. Third, college and university priority programs. ACE. Watley taught 6 different ACE courses, 2 of them ACE 9, which is the only ACE achievement that's specifically singled out in our college's strategic plan as being very important. Distance learning. Professor Watley uses online tools to meld together in his Religion 181 course 3 different courses, a lecture course for 120, an X course for 40 more students, and an advanced scholars course of 15, thus serving 175 students in the same course. I was planning on having him create the World Religions course, Religion 108, with the same sort of format. His loss will preclude that. We will lose his expertise in teaching technology as well as his student credit hour production. Thompson Learning Courses. With Professor Watley's departure, we have no flex left in our schedule. My faculty can no longer teach Thompson courses except as overloads. In conclusion, I believe that this cut really is a question of priorities rather than money. The dean has assured me he has no plans to discontinue the classics major at UNL. A Big Ten university must have a classics program. Professor Watley's departure endangers the undergraduate major in classics, since we only have 4 classicists on tenure line, 2 of them already past retirement age. When one of them retires, we will no longer have a major in classics. The dean has also assured me he has no desire to discontinue the religious studies major. The loss of Watley will damage this program as well, since two of the religious studies faculty, 1.5 FTE, are also past retirement age, I foresee the loss, with Professor Watley's contribution, of up to a quarter of our religious studies courses within the foreseeable future. This one cut disproportionately affects my small department. The department is losing 1/12 of its entire personnel, 1/8 if we only count those members who are under retirement age. In a word, I believe this cut to be penny wise and pound foolish. Thank you.
Thank you. Dean Landershein, would you like to come forward and why don't you just remain at the table if you wouldn't mind, because then we'll ask everyone questions.
I'm mostly here. I'm wearing my pain cap now. Not a cap as a member of APC, so that's why I'm sitting over here. And I'm mostly here to answer questions. I do want to say that you know, this cut illustrates the difficulty of the cuts we face on this point. On the other hand, the college believes that the department can absorb this cut by shifting resources, by shifting tenure-track faculty into lower-level courses. The department in the college has the fewest number of majors per FTE of any department. That's of concern to us. I don't want to eliminate that major. You quoted me absolutely correctly on the elimination of the major. But in view of the large number of low-enrollment courses in the department, we believe that by more streamlined moving the faculty into lower-level courses to teach the courses Professor Lobby would have taught, that this cut can be accomplished without diminishing credit hours. But there is that danger. There is that shifting of courses that needs to take place. But I'm also here to answer questions. So I'll do that.
Okay, thank you. Thank you. At that point, then we can start asking questions. Are there questions from the committee? Lane?
Yes. What you mentioned, what does happen if the faculty that are at retirement age would choose to retire, and then you would be between three? How many are at retirement age? 4.5. What would happen then if we eliminated a position and then four were chose to retire?
Right. Well, first off, on the question to use the term retirement age. There is no such thing as retirement age. Faculty members can retire when they want to. But that is a serious concern, and I share it with the department. There are a number of faculty members that are older than other faculty members in the college. And so if they were to retire, then one has to look at whether the major could be offered. And I think it's important to, in a college of arts and sciences, to offer that major and to provide that. But I think currently they have the enough staff to provide it.
Yeah. From the list of classes that Professor Watley teaches, he seems extraordinarily talented. Do you have that same kind of talent in the department to pick up this variety of courses here, or will some of these courses be run?
If this cut were approved, that would be something the department would have to work out. Professor Wadley would have another year in the position. And this is a renewal. He was up for renewal of his professor of practice appointment this year. So the timing was such that, you know, that he could have been renewed or not renewed at this point. It's a 3-year appointment. I think the faculty in that department, there's many excellent teachers in that department, so that they could teach many of these courses and could, through reorganization, meet those needs. You're right, we're taking a chance because we know we have a good teacher there. But we also one of the things I've done as dean is increase the percentage of credit hours taught by tenured and tenure track faculty. That's the way I've been able to keep increasing enrollment in the college with a decreasing budget. And so when we see excess capacity, we have to look at that.
Professor Burnett, would you care to comment on that as well?
Sure.
Dean Nadershide said that it would be something the department would have to say.
I suppose just two things. First of all, my actual plan had been that we would, that tenure line faculty would actually begin to teach more student credit hours, and that we would add those to what Professor Rockford was adding. So it is true that we can offer many more courses in introductory 100 level courses that are ACE courses, but it's our majors who will suffer, especially if we go through with our plans. It is, in fact, the first point in our strategic plan to recruit more majors. We're going to create bottlenecks by doing that. That I can guarantee you. Some of Professor Watley's courses will not be replaced because of either a lack of expertise or a lack of time. You know, we have only so many of us, and we can redeploy our resources teaching larger classes at the 100 and 200 level, but there are few enough of us, if you put all of our FTD together, that eventually you aren't really, you're making strategic choices that are going to leave big gaps in places. That's the problem.
Justin.
Sure. To piggyback off Dean Phillips' point, Dr. Ring, or Dean Mission, there's no doubt you're losing a pretty special faculty member. And I guess your plan is to move tenured faculty into this role in various ways. But those tenured faculty, correct me if I'm wrong, are research-based, less classroom-oriented, less focused on undergraduate education.
I wouldn't say that. I would say that these are faculty members that are research, like all faculty members, are researchers and teachers. What we see, though, is that some of the courses they're teaching now have very low enrollments, and that we could shift them to other courses and, I believe, still offer the major. But I wouldn't say that, you know, that these are inferior teachers in no way. We're not an achievement curriculum.
Are there any, my concern is we eliminate this position, and in my experience, tenured faculty are less, maybe gifted in the classroom with undergraduate students. No offense to tenured faculty. But and these professors of practice do a very good job connecting students and teaching them. So what's, is there any way to lessen the impact that this cut goes through on undergraduates or graduate education?
Well, I'll defer to Professor Burnett on this one. I think there are people in his department that can do the teaching, that can provide the same quality education. It may not be the same classes, it may not be the same instruction or technique that Professor Wiley provides. And if I had my brothers, we'd keep them, but I have to cut the budget. The university has to cut the budget. This is one thing that I don't want to do, but I didn't put it on the list. I sent it to the chancellor. He did choose it.
I like to think that tenure line professors can also teach. and in fact, there are several members of my department who either receive teaching awards or have received Parents Association awards. So it's the point is, though, not what we can do or not do, but the point is kind of the cost of what Professor Walkley has done and what we'll be losing.
David, what is the ratio of student credit hours to full-time equivalent faculty?
The ratio of student credit hours to full-time equivalent faculty? It's actually, I don't know the exact number. We can calculate. It's actually fairly good for that department because what they do is have a number of large enrollment classes. And so that is not a concern to me, that number. But what they do have is a number of small enrollment classes that I think if we didn't run those courses, if we ran them every other year, we could use those resources to teach more large enrollment classes than Professor Watley is teaching.
Dwayne, we do have some numbers on the Blackboard packet as well that we can look at. This happens a little too.
I thought as you were talking, and I was thinking about that you said, and maybe Dwayne was repeating that, that you mentioned something about the percentage of FTE by tenure track. Was that the number for you? Or the, you didn't give the actual number that you
I did mention that they had the Department of Classics and Religious Studies has the lowest number of majors per tenure track faculty. That's what I did mention.
Jerry.
Dean, if this is an inappropriate forum for this question, just tell me. But the situation sort of makes me, sort of seems to indicate an opportunity to talk about how professors of practice and tenured faculty are used and your philosophy in that.
Well, I think there's a role for both. And I think professors of practice can help us provide excellent instruction and also by their focus on teaching help us address issues where there's in departments where there's large enrollment issues, where there are large numbers of students and also large numbers of majors that need to be taught by the tenure track faculty. So I think they complement each other. I certainly am a supporter of the professor of practice role because I think it acknowledges something that we've had over a number of years, many senior lecturers that have taught for us for years and years.
I'd just like to make a point when Dean Manderscheid said we have courses that have lower enrollments and we can shift the faculty into those into higher enrollment courses. First of all of our faculty at some point in a three-year cycle teach 100-level large enrollment, 100-level courses, and Professor Burnett has accented that. And they teach 200-level courses also. But some of our large, our small enrollment courses are actually upper-level courses in Greek and Latin, which are part of a classics education. And Professor Burnett has already made the point. If we stop teaching them, we no longer have a classics program. That's a point I think that should come out.
Shall we?
I'd like to know the effect of eliminating the MA and classics on the possibility of a future combined master's in classics and religious studies, as was mentioned in your PR. Does this eliminate that possibility in the future?
I may be wrong here. I'm a first-year chair, and I've been known to make mistakes. But I believe that the official name of our master's program is the MA in Classics, and so this eliminates the entire graduate program, not just one part of it or something. So I look forward to life without having to deal with the post-secondary commission entirely.
So there will be no master's in religious studies?
None.
I mean, although currently there is not either. But your APR and your outside reviewers recommended giving your department time to look into changing your master's program so that it possibly could offer classics and religious studies. And this elimination eliminates any possibility of that also, correct?
Professor Burnett asked if I would respond since I was more involved in this. Our plan was, when we froze the classics MA program, to investigate whether we could change it into an MA program that's something like our undergraduate major, where students could track in either classics or religious studies. We also began investigating the possibility of joining forces with the religion department at UNO to see if we could come up with some kind of combined program there. And we were only in very preliminary talks with them about that. What our faculty as a department decided was that even if we combined forces, we didn't have enough faculty to be able to offer both our undergraduate majors and our graduate program. With the elimination of the classics MA, if we decided in some future time that our department had grown enough to reconsider offering an MA, we'd have to start from scratch now. We couldn't reconfigure.
I guess the classics program is currently configured. It is not owned by Professor Wong. Many of the teachers are. So the elimination of the classics program, we eliminated Professor Practice, who seems to be the primary person in that program. Is that
the case? Miles, we're as puzzled as you are by exactly what the connection is.
But I don't know if there's a justification that we're eliminating a program, and that therefore we can eliminate some personnel that are attached to that program, even though in real life that doesn't seem to be the case.
Our department's argument is that we effectively have not had an MA program now for 4 years, and that Professor Watley's departure will simply mean a cut in undergraduate education.
And in that case, that would be, to some degree, counter to the principles or the sort of follow in terms of protecting the core of the university. Why was Professor Watley made Professor Practice? I mean, somehow the idea that was he a minister or a rabbi? Or what is this practical orientation?
No, Professor Watley has a PhD in religious studies from the University of Virginia, but it's from Nebraska, and had come home to be near family, essentially his children, while he was finishing his dissertation and began teaching for us. Has proved to be a really,
you know,
a good member of our department.
So this cut of the classics masters not only affects the classics area, but also Hafiz's teaching as a religious studies, so it affects that undergraduate program.
You are correct.
Just because it's a big hall. His position is not aligned with his master's.
Can I comment on that? In some sense, his position was approved many years ago with the thought that we would be, you know, looking to enhance this program. But what has happened over the years has become clear as we've learned that you probably aren't going in that direction. Department has decided that with its resources can't do that. And now we see excess capacity, that there are a number of courses, not all required to major, that have low enrollments. And so that we don't see a need for his teaching as much if tenured and tenure track faculty were to take up that teaching.
This would be for any of you, but if I look at the bottom of the spreadsheet here, I see that the profit that has been garnered by tuition dollars that Professor Watson seemed to me, and I don't know if this is in conversation, if this would come up, if this cut would go through as proposed, he could be hired back to get a man twice the salary that he has here. And he would still have, you know, be generating some things to the department. Has this been any part of the discussion as far as May hiring and this matchup, as far as to meet some of these needs, or would there be any positives to that thought?
in the best of all possible worlds, all tuition dollars garnered by a department would come to that department for its operations. In our less than perfect world, no tuition dollars return except by indirect means. So, no, this is not department conversation. I would say here, though, that there's sometimes the attitude that it seems that all humanities courses are fungible. You know, that if somehow a humanities course is not taught here, that the student credit hours will be picked up someplace else. My answer to that is that anyone who thinks that is not taught the class that they thought was just wonderful, but had a very, very low enrollment because the students didn't want to go. Professor Watley has, in fact, attracted a lot of students to his courses, so he's not a perpetual tuition earner. His X course, actually, for this fall, just figuring on the basis of last year's tuition, stands to bring in something on the order of $23,000 for the university, 40% of which will go to the College of Arts and Sciences. So they're going to get a $9,500 boost to their budget next fall, but not in the fall of 2012.
I just have one quick question for Sydney, since she's been there the longest. When he first started, how many classes was he teaching, and how many has he added to his curriculum by staying for the 10 years?
When he began, he was teaching probably one course a semester for us. He also taught in the honors program, and that was under our rubric, but it was for the honors program. He also taught summer school and evening. So, he's had put together, as many adjuncts do, a lot of courses. When he went on a half-time contract, he was teaching three courses for us, and then he was also picking up, again, adjunct work. And then when he went full-time, he taught six courses for us and has not had to have any adjunct work.
Are there any further questions from the committee?
Am I reading this correctly, that his current salary is $32,000?
That would be without benefits. If I put the whole package together, we're talking about $40,852 a month.
All right, well, thank you very much, Professor Burnett, Professor Martin, Dr. Okay. The next item on the agenda is the hearing on the engineering, which is to eliminate industrial and management systems engineering in the College of Engineering. Originally, Professor Hallbeck had been scheduled to talk, but she has decided that she will remain here only as a resource for questions, as will several other of the faculty, and I have a request from both David Cochran and Bob Williams to talk, and so they may have Professor Hallbeck's time.
Thank you. I'm Bob Williams, an associate professor at IMSC, and I first want to start out and say I'm just talking for myself here, although I do feel that several of my colleagues share the same sentiments that I'm going to share. As much as I respect the mission and the function of the APC, my opinion is that this meeting is moot. The actions that the university has taken in the last month have really caused irreparable harm to the department and the programs. Analogy I gave one of my colleagues late last week was that they harvested the organs before the patient was dead. And just as an example, a few days after the chancellor made his budget recommendations, the senior vice chancellor's office sent out a letter to all of our current graduate students. And to be honest, that was the first time in this whole process that I really got angry when I saw that letter. That letter effectively killed off our graduate programs at that time. The dean happened to be walking by. Myself and a couple of colleagues grabbed him, showed him the letter. He admitted openly to us that letter should never have gone out. So that's just one example. I'm not here to try to ask for a delay, for more time. I personally have no interest in us getting a one-year stay of execution at this point. So either leave us alone, give us the resources to be successful, or go ahead and develop a plan, teach out our students, and help take care of all the tenured faculty that you've said publicly and that you've said to us individually. This is a tough time. It's a sad time for me personally. Not only am I a tenured faculty member in this department, I'm an alumni. I have two of my degrees from this department. I'm a parent of a graduate. My son works for a local company. I think one of the companies that has probably sent a letter here talking about how important our discipline is to our constituents, the local companies, and also the students. In case you're not aware, there are no other IE programs in the state. The closest ones would be at Kansas State or Iowa State. So we are meeting a need to our Nebraska business community and to our students and our constituents. But it's a shame. It's a shame that according to the recent NRC report that came out, we were one of the top, if not the top rated PhD program on this campus. And now we're going to be eliminated. Okay. That's all I have to say. Thank you.
Professor Cochran?
Not John. Okay. As I walked here, I swore that I would not speak. However, I'm here talking. The second thing is, I'm dead. So if you ask me questions, please do it slowly, distinctly, and loudly. Now, to me, this boils down to a question of four things. Leadership, process, metrics, and value. Well, my colleagues on other campuses, namely Ohio State, over the last 5 years or so, have had committees formed, or a committee formed in the College of Engineering to decide how to organize that college, what its strengths were, what its weaknesses were, how they could improve, and how to restructure so that they would be successful in the next decade or more. We haven't done that. I've been here almost 40 years. We've never done that. As a college or a university. It's a total lack of leadership. Process. I think Bob stated it quite succinctly. We were told we were going to be eliminated. It was kind of like, you're gone. Metrics. 3 years ago, they announced they were going to eliminate this department, and they based their decision on undergraduate enrollment. Over the 3 years, we have improved that. The ratio of faculty, to students has improved. We are retiring 4 faculty members, and quite honestly, that will improve our ratio. Doesn't matter. We don't know what the metric is. 1 minute is undergraduate enrollment. The next minute is how many dollars you bring into this college. Or how many graduates do you graduate, or whatever, whatever, whatever. We don't know. There's no established metric in this university or college for success. Now, in engineering, when I came here, it was scholarly activity. It's now money. However, in other colleges, it's not money. Is that equitable? I don't think so. I think there are some fine scholars that don't bring in money that we should retain in the College of Engineering. I do agree that we should pursue research money. Value. Ideas of a value to this state. This state needs ideas. We are an under-industrialized state except for agriculture, which is an industry. It uses IEs. It uses all the principles and methods we teach in IE. Our graduates have become entrepreneurs, vice presidents. They're problem solvers. They're successful. Nobody criticizes our graduates. They're damn good. We're proud of them. We even have one that is a referee for the NFL. Now, that's a strange use of an engineer, but it is use. He's very good, or he wouldn't be there. So, you know, when I look at this, I look at something that's haywire, that's gone wrong. We don't have a faculty governance that monitors this process. If we do, I don't see it. We don't have leadership that would lead us to become a successful institution and a successful college. And I have a saying that comes from military, and it is, you are responsible as a leader for everything your unit does or fails to do. You can be the judge. I'm finished. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Professor Cochran. We have a graduate research assistant, Lindsay Ekstrom, who would like to speak.
What's that?
We just hand this over to Lindsay.
Oh, Lindsay, I'm sorry.
Lindsay, would
Hey, I am here on behalf of the Quorum and present students. I just graduated my master's on Friday. And so this department means the world to me. I've been here the past 6 years. And from ages 18 to 24, which I believe are very crucial years in a person's life, the department and all the professors guide me on a path that led to and will continue to lead me to success. And so that's why I'm here. And I know all the students would stand behind me with what I have to say about this department. And because of what they've done for me, IMFB will forever be a part of me. So I decided to come and share my input and value to this department. So coming to UNL, first of all, as a girl and loving calculus and science, I decided to go engineering when my parents convinced me. And after one very brief conversation with Dr. Ballard on what IMSC is and what it can lead to, I signed up right away. And I have not looked back. It's been a wonderful journey. And I just think it's led to many great opportunities. You can work in any industry. I've met so many people. I've had so many job offers that will lead me to success. And I found out my cousin who's coming here next fall. She's very talented, very smart, was going to sign up for IMSC, and I was so proud and I'm so excited for her. And now she doesn't know what to do because they're cutting the program. So I hope this can change your mind, because a lot of women do go into this field too. It's very versatile. It offers many different management skills, business skills, engineering skills, and that's why you can go into the working world and work anywhere. And I have had no problem finding jobs in this tough economy because they are needed and wanted everywhere. And also, I wanted to now move into the potential that this department has. Recently, Dr. Hallbeck taught a healthcare engineering course, and that's recently new. And with this engineering in healthcare, there could be this great program built between UNMC, the VA Medical Center, and other hospitals in Lincoln, and we can work to improve healthcare. And that draws a lot of people in because it's definitely needed. And these students do have the potential to change the healthcare world without being a healthcare professional. And also, with some competitors, they have five-year programs where they offer bachelor's and master's degrees. And we were getting ready to form something like that. The students were excited because engineering is already probably a 4.5-year program. So extending it by one semester and getting that master's is very appealing to students like me. And I think that can definitely increase our student enrollment. So things looking at future potential, I think, is very important. I don't think we're doing that, or at least we are, but others don't see the potential we have. And then last, I wanted to close with just a remark, and I hate saying this, but I do feel that I am on a great path to success, and I am eager to give back to the department. I want to give money back to you now. But now that this is happening, I don't want to give any money back, ever. And talking to former IE grads and just dealing, you know, hearing their emotions about this, they are not happy either. And so I just asked them if they'd ever donate money, and they said they would never do it. And so you have to think about the future of UNL too. This is not only hurting us, the professors, the students, it's hurting UNL in the long run too, because there will not be any donations. And engineers make money. They will be successful. They will give back. And this department does mean the world to me. And it means the world to so many other students. And I wouldn't be here today if it wasn't for the professors, because every single professor in this department I have a solid, great relationship with. And they are the reason I am on the path to success today.
Thank you. Dino Hanlon? Is Dino Hanlon here?
Well, as Bob pointed out, we're working on figuring out ways to teach out all students at both undergraduate and graduate level. We can maintain our ABET accreditation for undergraduate program for 3 additional years, which should give us time to get all students completed. It looks like some of the doctoral students will go with the tenured faculty as they move to the tenured homes. We have 7 tenured faculty. We're in the process of working with them as they move to new department homes. 3 are pretty well set. The other 4 are in the process. We'd like to maintain the Master of Engineering program because it serves a really unique audience that is not served in the rest of the college. I'm not sure how we're going to do that yet, but we're going to try to find a way to do it. And we're also going to look and see if we can have an IMSE concentration, maybe a minor or something with one of the other departments. But there's a lot of detail to all of that, and we're far from being complete on any of those details. Happy to respond to any questions that you may have.
Thank you, Dino Hanlon. Are there questions? Justin.
Yeah, this is for Dino Hanlon. In all likelihood, the College of Engineering will have differential tuition in place for students by June, when the board or President Milken approves it, which provides a very unique ability of that college to raise funds to keep programs within the cut. Not to mention there's already a professional fee added on the students, which would increase that differential tuition number even higher. So why is your college cutting when students are going to be continually charged more and more?
I didn't have the last question.
I said, why are we, if we're cutting and things like that, why is differential tuition happening now? And why can't, or, you know, when you're authorized to do differential tuition, is that not a feasible way of maintaining this program?
Well, the professional fee that you referred to has been in place for several years. It was used mainly to increase the size of the faculty, which has helped us as the student numbers, both in the undergraduate and graduate level of college, have increased. The differentiated tuition will go for a number of different purposes, one of which will be to improve the laboratories in the college, which obviously are an important part of the instructional program for undergraduates. We're also short on things like laboratory technicians and other kinds of staff that support the faculty and support the student in the teaching programs. I think the notion of the differentiated tuition also was to enable us to increase the student numbers in some programs where there's very high demand, where we're having to turn away students now. For example, mechanical engineering is a good example of that.
Thank you. So is there a potential to use the preferential tuition to prevent cuts of programs like this?
In the first place, we don't have the differential tuition at this point. And second place, if you apply all the differentiated tuition, I suppose you could, but that would mean that you cannot do these other things that it's planned for. We would increase enrollment in other programs where there's bigger demand.
Thank you.
Are there other questions?
How many faculty and how many majors are there in this program?
There are 7 tenured faculty. There's 1 non-tenured faculty, and then there's a lecturer in the program.
They have majors.
5 minimum.
The different programs?
Yeah.
Referring to, we have an undergraduate in BS in industrial engineering.
Yeah.
We have a master of science in industrial engineering. We also have, there's on the books, an interdepartmental master of science in manufacturing. Systems engineering, which is actually college-wide, but we administer it. We haven't had a lot of graduates in that lately. And then we have been administering the overall college-wide Master of Engineering, as well as our area of specialization in engineering management, which is probably the most popular of all those areas of specialization underneath that. And then we have our own specialization area within the unified PhD program at college.
So are all those majors being eliminated?
Well, we talked about the Master of Engineering that Bob referred to. That's the biggest one, and that's the one we're going to try to continue because it does serve an audience that we don't serve elsewhere in the college. It's indicated, I think, that at least some of the doctoral students will go with the faculty to the new doctoral program areas, whether they're faculty or the department. There are 60 or so undergraduates that we need to include. 60 or so undergraduates that we need to include.
52.
How many of your faculty that have decided to move will move regardless of what happens with the APC decision?
That's a good question. I really can't answer that. I mean, to be honest, in my own case, that's something I've thought about, something I've told some of my colleagues that no matter what gets recommended here, if irreparable harm has been done, which I think it has, like I said, even if we're given another year or two to come up with whatever metric, some of us may still decide. I mean, just for an example, I've been teaching a course for mechanical engineering for the whole year. That was something that started when we were, a year or so ago when we were talking about merging industrial engineering with mechanical and engineering mechanics. You know, they've gone ahead with that other merger. We've been left out of it, but as part of that, we were going to pick up some of the load that they had. And I personally already was part of that. So for some of us, I mean, it is a pretty natural transition to go to some other areas. It's not as clear cut for some faculty. That's one of the issues.
Absolutely.
Have you tried to find a home for those people that might not be the perfect fit, like you just said before?
We're working on it. I think it's going to work out for everyone. But this has come up kind of quickly, and with the end of semester tests and everything, we haven't gotten them all done. As Bob points out, it's a more natural move for some than others. And the three that pretty much are in place are ones where it was a very, very easy move, but
but I think to add to that, I think the faculty are a little nervous, even though we've been, promised some of these things. We don't have anything in writing, and some of us have had our meetings with prospective new departments. But there's a procedure we have to follow, and most of us, I think, don't want to start down that path until we know what the official word is going to be. But I think most of us are nervous because we don't have anything official yet.
Over the last 10 years or so, what's been the relative percentage of females in the program versus males? And of the females, how much of that is, of the female population in the college, how much would that have been in IE?
I think our numbers were in the low to mid 20% of our undergraduate student population, of our student population was female. And I think at one time only BSE at a higher percentage. We put these numbers together when we were going through this merger process. In fact, I was one of the ones that did that. Talking to John Ballard, he also said, so I mean, you know, we have, again, I think we have the second highest in college. We probably accounted for, you know, a fair number of the overall college numbers in diversity as well. That was one of the things in that, you know, NRC report that we looked very, very good at was diversity. Students, faculty, undergraduate and graduate students, and faculty.
Can any of you recall when the last academic program review was in the department? And what were any of the recommendations or findings of that?
To my knowledge, we never had.
Never had a program review?
To my knowledge, we've never had one, ever.
Have you given any thought to how 206 or 321 are going to be handled in the future? Or has anybody been circling around asking for those particular courses?
It's come up in conversation that some of us have had with respect to new departments, but to be honest, that's really not something that, you know, us as individual faculty are really should be worrying about.
For clarification for the rest of the committee, 206 and 321 are required courses for almost all engineers that reside in the INSE department. So most majors take them.
Yeah, you know, that's a good question because, everything kind of has to fall in place at once. Depends on where people go, whether those departments will take over those courses. At this point, that's not an answerable question for us.
Is it Lindsay?
Yeah.
Lindsay, since you represent a valuable constituency, do you think that 15-year-olds graduating from Nebraska High School will look at the college of engineering and not see the home at this point, or will there be attractive alternatives to the people studying in the U.S.?
I do think they could find a home, but as far as having alternatives to go to in the College of Engineering, no. Because when I came in, I just loved math and science, and I'm a people person, just because it perfectly with what I wanted to do. And looking at all the other degrees, great engineering degrees, but it wasn't a good fit for me. I would have left the College of Engineering and gone somewhere else.
So people still, or people still?
Definitely. I would definitely say the industrial engineering realm is consists of well-rounded individuals. They have people skills, they're knowledgeable, they can do a variety of tasks, and that's why I think it's so versatile and we need that. Like Dr. Williams said, for the state of Nebraska, I think it's vital to keep going and competing against Iowa State, Kansas State, Georgia Tech. A lot of our grads went to Georgia Tech for master's programs. That's the number one school. And so they did prepare us well for the future and for especially the real world. And we had jobs lined up for almost everyone. And I've had no problem job hunting, and I just keep turning them down until I find that perfect opportunity. And it's great to have that feeling where people can't find jobs and we are getting flooded with job opportunities. That's why it makes no sense to me to cut this program, especially since engineers will make a decent amount of money and will be successful. And we do have that management style built in naturally, and we are the ones who build up the ladder in this competition.
Justin, do
you? Well, I guess I'd like to ask Dean Hanley, given that perspective, is there any data that would suggest that this program is particularly attractive to employers, more so than other programs? I don't know if there is any data. I mean, a graduate of this program has been heavily recruited, whereas in other majors, that's not the case.
Yes, it is.
It is.
It's true that some of the students that come into IMSE are not ones that start there, but come into that because they find it, you know, it's not something they necessarily know about before they arrive on campus. Ideally, we have a big, strong IMSE department. idea that we'd also have an apartment there, aerospace and engineering and so on and so on. But as you would all know better than anybody, there's a restriction on our resources.
Let me have a quick question. What's the job outlook for State of State for graduate students?
That's actually, there are lots of positions, and that's what I've been mainly offered. Omaha is a great industry, and we have undergrads starting out at 60-65, which is bachelor's.
Yep. And there are, so there is a need for this in the state of Nebraska.
There is.
Are there further questions? All right, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And we're running just a few minutes behind schedule, but I think it's important that we get all the questions answered. So it is a few minutes after 3 right now. But we will continue on. The next item of business is the hearing on the Fine and Performing Arts proposed budget cut to eliminate the study of organ in the School of Music. Professor Christopher Marks is our first speaker.
I'd like to speak today about the value of the organ to the university, its students, and the state of Nebraska, and allow my previously submitted memo to this committee to make points directly in reference to the budget reduction procedures. This proposed reduction is not a vertical cut. Organ is not an isolated, standalone program that can easily or effectively be extricated without severely impacting the overall quality of the student experience. Organ students have consistently collaborated with instrumental ensembles like the UNL Symphony Orchestra, the Wind Ensemble, the Symphonic Band. At least 2 choral concerts every semester incorporate organ, usually featuring student organists. Organists consistently perform as part of chamber ensembles. I myself have performed in concert with faculty colleagues in voice, flute, oboe, violin, trumpet, trombone, viola, cello, tuba, and of course, organ is heard at every UNL commencement ceremony. Discussions about organ at state universities are inevitably darkened by the narrow-minded view that organs only belong in houses of worship. Let me suggest, instead, that the university embrace the organ's role in such community organizations. With rapidly decreasing support for arts in public schools and university elimination of education in the arts, churches and synagogues fill the gap. Far from being places exclusively for worship services, churches are active in promoting the arts, music, sculpture, dance, literature, drama, in their worship and everyday life through education, concert series, exhibitions, guest lectures. Organists, as directors of church music, are central to this initiative. And in Nebraska, these organists are our students and graduates. They reach thousands of Nebraskans every single week with their work. Is there a better way to measure the impact of the instrument? The university, I think, has an obligation to foster arts culture in the state, but also to equip students with skills that lead to postgraduate employment. Professional musicians have to be incredibly versatile, and organ is a readily marketable skill. There are at least 7 students I know of who want to study organ here in the fall, not as majors, but as smart musicians who want to increase their employment opportunities. Most students of the organ, even if it is not their primary instrument, work professionally as an organist even while in school. How many areas of study here can say that of their students? How can UNL deny its music students the opportunity to study an instrument that has real-world application for current and future employment? The organ has a longer continuous history of use than any other instrument besides the human voice. Landmark works of Western art music were written for it. Any serious program of music in higher education, especially at a flagship school, must include instruction and research in organ. Any institution that ignores its importance risks being taken less seriously among peer institutions and offers a lesser education to all of its music students. But I'm not naive enough to think that the historical significance of the instrument, its long history here at UNL, or my own achievements as a teacher and performer are enough to stay the swinging axe today. These facts should not be dismissed, but I want to focus on the present and the future. Organ is not just a historical instrument, but one in continuous and conspicuous use today. The discouraging and centuries-old misconception that organ is dead persists, but nothing could be further from the truth. I just visited Kansas City, where a new performing arts center is being built with a $2 million new organ. Similar installations have recently gone into halls in cities like Nashville, Philadelphia, and Los Angeles. Clearly, the music profession takes the organ seriously, as should any school that wishes to prepare its students for real-world experiences. Every summer, through the American Guild of Organists, I work with teenagers who learn about the organ with an enthusiasm that they carry with them through the rest of their lives, whether or not they become professional organists. If this is not a lively tradition, then what is? Finally, I want to say that I hope that this committee will try to ensure that all of these proposals are being made for the right reasons. When decisions are made out of convenience, behind subterfuge, and with disregard for procedure, they can only weaken the institution. It's vital that these decisions be made with transparency and integrity, and that the future of the state of the arts in Nebraska not be impoverished as a result. And last, I just want to thank my many faculty and community colleagues and students who have shown up here today to support me. Appreciate that. Thank you.
Thank you. Dina Leba? Oh, and Professor Richmond as well.
Thank you. John and I are going to speak a little bit about the history of the program here, those of you who don't know, and also about the situation that we're in today. Many of you will know that the UNL organ program has enjoyed a long and distinguished history at UNL, served by nationally renowned choral artists and scholars on our faculty. Dr. Maureen Roberts served here from 1940 to 1974 and brought national attention to the organ program through his effective teaching, his guidance in the pipe organ acquisitions, and the compositional efforts for the instrument. Doctors George Ritchie and Quentin Faulkner then built upon this momentum and expanded the organ program by virtue of their own research and creative activities in organ scholarship and recording projects for the organ, as well as by their launching of a national organ conference on our campus and their tours of historically important pipe organs in Europe. There are few in the professional organ community who do not know the impressive history and trajectory of the pipe organ instruction and scholarship at UNL.
Drs. Ritchie and Faulkner announced in 2004 their intentions to retire in spring 2006. During the 2005-06 academic year, the School of Music made two important strategic decisions. The first was to repurpose one of the faculty lines in pipe organ to musicology and conducted a national search for a scholar with expertise in the history of jazz and the history of music for film. This search was successful and a third historian joined our ranks in fall 2006. The second was to search for a faculty member with expertise in both pipe organ performance and academics. That is to say, music theory or history or literature. The search was fashioned this way in recognition of the fact that at the time of their retirements, Drs. Ritchie and Faulkner provided a combined 1.0 FTE in music academics to the instructional program of the School of Music. We conducted a national search and recruited Dr. Christopher Marks to the faculty. In his letter of appointment dated March 29, 2006, he was told that his teaching assignment would be, quote, divided equally between applied organ recruitment and maintenance, to recruit and maintain an outstanding studio of nine majors, graduate and undergraduate combined, and academics and music to include history, literature, theory, etc., as assigned by the director of the School of Music or the director's designee, end quote. Because the competition for stellar organ majors has been increasingly intense, Dr. Mark's assignments have evolved to teach more academic courses. Thus, his teaching contributions across the School of Music have become greater as his academic course profile has increased and has benefited not only organ majors, but the entire student body.
Today, Dr. Marks teaches undergraduate courses in music theory and church music. He also teaches applied music to organ students, not majoring in organ performance, but desiring to acquire facility in pipe organ. At the graduate level, he teaches courses in church music and also teaches the doctoral seminar in performance practice. Thus, the decision to eliminate the organ program impacts not only the students majoring in organ, but much of the rest of the school music body as well. Eliminating this faculty line will necessitate larger section enrollments in the required undergraduate music theory courses, which are required of every music major. It also means a more narrow rotation of topics in the various sections of the doctoral seminar in performance practice, and that the School of Music will have to hire an organist from the community or beyond each time an ensemble, one of our performing ensembles, performs a music composition calling for the pipe organ as one of the instruments in the score.
The School of Music now receives only $84,707 in operating funds plus our payroll budget from state funds and the university budget. Nearly 35% of that operating budget is consumed each year simply paying for our phone bill. In other words, nearly all of the operating expenses we require to run the school are provided by earnings from our MU foundation endowments, not state funds. Thus, we now find ourselves losing faculty and staff every time there is a budget question. In the last 8 years, the School of Music has lost a full-time dance faculty position, a full-time instrument repair technician position, a half-time secretary position, and now the proposed elimination of our organ program and the award-winning faculty member who serves it so well. The School of Music has been impacted substantially by these recent budget cuts. We felt it was important that the Academic Planning Committee understand this proposed reduction in the context of our recent history. Thank you.
Thank you.
Entertain any questions you might have.
Yeah, further questions from the committee?
You know, the process, as I understand it, and I think we understand it, is that the themes of the different colleges propose possible items for the chancellor to consider and he makes his own decisions.
Correct.
So, with that understanding, it was suggested you propose this as a possible relation.
There's no secret that it was on the list, but simply you understand the context within which we do that. A 1% reduction in our college is about $100,000. I can't make a 0.5% reduction without putting a faculty member on the line. It's impossible. So I requested to propose 5% model by the chancellor. You can understand the impact of that and what I have to work with. If I go above 1.5%, I'm into tenured faculty. I'm into programs that have enrollment in them considerably more. I'm into programs that are generating significantly higher degrees. So it's if you also were to analyze the way the programs in our college are structured, and I would say this happens across all three units, art and art history, music, and theater and film, but particularly in music, the way the programs are structured, more than half the faculty are required for the core instruction. And then if you add the faculty whose assignments are primarily in applied music, it takes us to about 95% of the faculty in the School of Music that have to be on hand to provide core instruction for the music students, regardless of which degree program they're in. Because we have applied music, you have ensembles, many faculty, Chris is a good example, who not only teach in the applied area, but also teach in the academic side, and some of them also conduct an ensemble. So to sit down and break that apart is a challenge. But nevertheless, if we're trying to isolate things in the School of Music and the Department of Art and History and Theater and Film and come to 5% budget cut, it's impossible to do it. So, and we, if John is correct, John's explanation of how many dollars he has from state dollars to support the operating budget is even more severe in art and in theater and film.
So if APC should choose to not recommend this, the chancellor might come back to you and say, well, find another place to come up with some money.
Precisely. And given the amount of money we're talking about, it could be between a bigger rock and a hard place because of tenure faculty.
And I have one more question. So the way we get the language, it suggests that organ is a program. Is this common in the college for there to be a program in the trombone, or the trumpet, or the violin, or the organ? Is that the common configuration?
We teach all those applied instruments. I wouldn't say that organ is any different than any of the others in that respect.
So this is a program of one factor. Is that correct?
If you want to categorize it that way, yes.
Can I address that question?
Yeah.
I think it's a semantic issue. I think that we often casually refer to individual instruments as programs in everyday language, but in fact the program is in performance or in music education, and our individual instruments are a part of that. And I think we're seeing a problem between casual terminology versus more realistic terminology. I don't really consider myself a single-handed, in fact, half faculty line program, or even a department, as some people would refer to me single as a department. That doesn't make sense, but we occasionally use that terminology casually. I don't think it holds the kind of meaning that you might attach to it in this sort of context.
One of the comments we heard is that maintaining organs was incredibly expensive. I've since heard some controversy about that. I wonder if you could speak to that, that was one rationale.
We have a concert instrument in the Kimball Recital Hall, and we have a teaching studio and four practice room instruments in the basement. The Kimball Hall. We signed a service contract with a local service provider who tunes and maintains those instruments under the terms and conditions of the contract. We will need to retain the concert instrument at the very least, regardless of what happens in this budget reduction exercise, for the reasons cited in terms of the repertoire and its requirement of the pipe organ on many occasions. So that instrument will remain and be maintained regardless of this process.
Dean Oliva, this situation with Dr. Marks is unique in those that we're considering today, in particular, I think, because of the situation, the process situation. And can you just address if there were any concerns about process, I mean, what can you say to the committee to reassure us about process?
Tell me a little bit more about what you're asking about.
Well, process. I'm looking. The timeline of events here is, for Dr. Mark, sad and frustrating, and it's. I just want to make sure that it's also, unfortunate, but not procedurally problematic.
Yeah, the college has followed the procedures that the university has set out ever since we've been talking about budget cuts. And I've been here 10 years and we've talked about them for six or maybe seven. In each of those, we propose, we're given a number, and in that number, we have to propose scenarios for the JAMC to consider. It's no secret that this program and others have been in this mix for a couple of years. And the process has not changed. We've used that same process, and we've proposed options to the chancellor, and the chancellor makes the choices that he deems that he wants to make. And you can look at the array of different cuts. John's talked about a few. We also, if you remember, in the last round, lost 80% of Dan Lavey's position in the Ross. That was a position that, over time, and with some bridge money, we're able to, I think, reach some sustained plan for the Ross in the future in terms of its own revenue. But that's the process that's been used in our college is no different than in any other college that we've used over the last 10 years since I've been here.
You just used the word program, and so I wondered if you could elaborate on how you define a program. Is a program an instrument? Is a program a degree? Is a program a affiliated with particular faculty or
and I've looked at that before. I think when you talk about music or when you talk about even if you look at the parallel in art history, it's very difficult. In some institutions you could say we're going to eliminate the painting program because the way the students study painting, they come and they major in painting, or they major in photography, they major in something else. So while they might need some painting courses in their curriculum, some
painting courses in a curriculum, the sculpture student might come and study primarily all the sculpture. In our college, it's a lot more difficult to do that because the program is integrated. And I think our music program is the same way. And Chris is absolutely right when he talks about options to study applied music. But I think it's also fair to say that not every school of music in the country offers all the instruments that can possibly be offered. And some of the decisions are made on cost to operate those programs, to include the comment that Nancy made about sustaining the equipment and those types of things. And so there have been decisions made in our own Big Ten CIC in the last couple of years where organ programs, however you want to define that, the opportunity to study organ as an applied instrument have been eliminated because of various reasons. I'm not sure I have Chris is right too. I mean, you can talk about semantics and how we define a program or not define a program. I think in the case of music, it's more, I think, a fairer way to look at it in terms of the options you offer students to come and study their applied music, to the applied area that they're going to study.
So would some particular aspect of the vocal music degree be a program, like to eliminate
not quite sure we could go that far. You can consider marching band a program if you wanted to. You can consider opera a program if you wanted to. You can consider music education a program if you wanted to. I mean, you could sit down and draw the lines, but I mean, it's not an easy definition as we look at it within the disciplines in our college, the way they're constructed. And that's the sort of sensitive point I'm trying to make in terms of the challenge.
Does it still work the same in fine and performing arts? Because you can't define a program by media or by instrument, or...
It's a lot more challenging. So you could use theater as an example. So if you're going to have an undergraduate acting program, you can't have an undergraduate acting program without also having a design program to support. So you could say, well, we'll eliminate the design program. Who do you eliminate? Then you eliminate lighting designers and set designers and costume designers, and then now you have an acting program with that. So, I mean, the programs in our college are very integrated, so it presents a challenge. But in the context of that challenge, 5% is 5%. So we have to figure out a way to be part of the whole in the institution. As a dean of the college, I can't, you know, go to the chancellor every time one of these things comes up and say, well, gee, thank you, but our college is different. I have to, in what I think is sort of my best consultation with the chairs and in the spirit of certainly fighting for our programs in the college, if I have to go up to 5%, we have to put the options out there. And I think that's the situation we're in. That's all I can say, I guess.
So do you consider this a vertical cut?
Well, I consider if the cut goes away, we lose a faculty member who not only teaches organ as an instrument, whether it's for students who are going to get a degree in organ or students who are going to take organ instruction and maybe they're a trombone student or maybe they're a student in art, and also one who contributes to the other part of the academic mission. But John, maybe speaks one thing.
Nobody here wants to cut anything. And the reason that I wanted to provide the kind of historical context in the narrative that Jack and I read into the record today is because we're looking down the barrel of nothing but painful cuts. It was painful before. Is there another way to get our instruments repaired? Yeah, we figured that out. Is there another way to provide clerical support in the unit? Yes, we figured that out. But now we're at a juncture where everything's going to hurt. And speaking here into the process question that you raised earlier about the timing of all of this, I must tell you that I could not have been more surprised, dumbfounded, thunderstruck by learning of this and than anyone with a possible exception of Chris, because we thought this was, we thought we were fine, to be honest. I mean, in terms of
moving forward, and I just thought we were past this question quite honestly. And we did follow all the processes and procedures of the institution, not only with respect to questions about proposals for budget, but this has been, as Jack mentioned, this has just kind of been a cloud hanging over all of us for a while. But in terms of moving forward with promotion, tenure, and all of those sorts of things, we just thought we were fine. We just thought, based on everything that we were hearing, all of the feedback we were getting, that there was nothing looming for us.
But you wouldn't say, or would you, that there was subterfuge or anyone was misleading or any there were any issues?
Nothing of which I'm aware. And certainly nothing of which I'm a part.
My question.
Okay, question. Miles.
Well, Chris, I think maybe the reason why some of us are interested in the program issues is because the heart of cutting a tenured position is this business of whether or not a program is being cut or whether an individual professor is being, who tenure is being cut. If Oregon is a program, that provides a justification or rationale for eliminating somebody who's almost got tenure. I realize it's a very sticky matter.
Well, I think that this is going to be one of the situations where everybody who looks at it sees something just a little bit different. From my point of view, I don't stand alone as a program. I stand as part of a larger program. And you've heard it enough to know how interrelated everything is in our School of Music and other arts programs here on campus. So I'll say I'm not a standalone program, despite the occasional casual use of that word in conversation that I think will continue to persist. But and you will look at it, you may see something different. I don't know what else to say.
I'm just naive to the way that your college works because it is very different and unique because of the foundation funding for that. But am I correct? $84,000 in state funding. That was just.
Yeah. The funding we get for our operating budget from the state beyond payroll, $84,707 in school.
So
we have payroll plus $84,707, and about a third of that goes for our funds.
I was just confused because you eliminated that $68,000 that you deducted.
There's a pot of money that pays personnel. It's one pot of money. That's the largest pot of money. Then there's monies that are used to turn your lights on, to run your Xerox, to run your phones, all that stuff. That's the $84,000. So.
A large chunk of that had been surrendered from previous budget reductions.
We're going to whittle that down.
Significantly.
And because most of these have.
That's what I'm saying.
This is not just about our college when it comes to operating money. Absolutely. To be fair.
Just a quick question. Did you lose any faculty members early retirement?
We lost two.
You lost two.
We, let me say this, two retired. We replaced one. Replacing the ceramics. Ceramics is one of the top 10 ceramics programs in America, and that's why we requested it. It's a strategic decision. And the second line is still, as far as I know, it's in the college, but it will be part of a wider conversation about recapturing these lines if the deans will be engaged with the vice chancellor. But the decision to replace the one we did was a strategic one based on the reputation of the program, the reputation of graduates
who have met
that program
and
so on.
Okay, further questions, John?
Do you see any ripple effects from this? I mean, does eliminating Oregon, does that make UNL a less attractive place to study vocal music or whatever?
To whom are you addressing any question?
People who are moving to whatever.
Yes, it does. Of course it does. The more comprehensive the music school is, the more attractive it is. The more robust and complete the instructional, artistic, and scholarly program, the more engaging, the more compelling. And again, the more
symbiotically rich that experience is. So yes, of course he wants it.
Are those effects greater with Oregon or other instruments, or is it would be with that be eliminated something else?
I can't do a music school without the set of resources that are represented in the traditions. I'll give you some examples of music we don't teach. So we don't teach accordion. We don't teach crumb horn. There are a variety of kinds of things, both ancient and current, that we don't teach now. So do I think that we have to teach every imaginable instrument that could be taught now? I don't think that. Are we richly situated in the Western European tradition of art music and jazz? We are. Do we serve it well? We do. Do we need to have the representative entities that are implied in that mission in place? We do. We can't not teach tenors. Or soprano, sorry. Somebody's still obsessing on the whole soprano question. We make light of this serious stuff, and we really, I'm just letting you know that this will hurt, and so would any alternative. Because we're already not teaching the course.
Nina Lee, this one, this question's for you. Just, I guess, what I understand now about the college model and why this, this effectively, I think it's fair to say, impacts the students in the college platform.
I would say it has a strong impact on the students in the school of music.
Okay.
Yeah, it would not be a fair thing to say that it cuts across all the disciplines, because the disciplines, while related as arts disciplines, are very distinct. It would be the school.
Which has how many students?
We have 400 music majors, 250 undergraduates, and 150 graduate students.
Thank you.
Are there any more questions from the committee? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We had originally scheduled a 10-minute break. We have run over a little bit, but I think we should take about 6 or 7 minutes. Let's try and reassemble here at about 22.
Okay.